Okay, maybe we can begin now. So our speaker for this week is Dr. Scott Morrison from the Australian National University. He's a senior lecturer. And he did his PhD in Berkeley under the supervision of Morgan Jones of the Jones Polynomial. And his talk today is, do you remind me of the title?
Let's find out.
Not so quantum computation. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for the introduction. Thanks for the opportunity to speak here today. So if you leave this talk with just one sentence remembered, which is fine, that'll be a great outcome, the sentence is this one that you can see here. The Jones polynomial is as hard as quantum computation and can be calculated using topological field. And basically the entire point of what I wanted to do today is explain what all the words in that sentence mean and roughly why it's both a true and very interesting statement. So we're going to spend a little while, I'm going to tell you from scratch what on earth this thing, the Jones polynomial, is. I'm going to talk a little bit about what quantum computation means, and then we'll try and prove something. We'll make precise this statement that the Jones polynomial is precisely as hard as quantum computation. And then at the end of the talk, I'll try and explain how this idea of topological field theory, and maybe some particular instances of topological field theory, can enable you to do the calculations that we've been talking about in the first part of the talk. Okay, so let's go learn about the Jones polynomial. So the Jones polynomial is a Laurent polynomial that's an invariant of links. So if you hand me any tied up piece of string, or maybe several pieces of string, a link, the Jones polynomial will look at that and spit out some Laurent polynomial, maybe in some parameter Q. So here, sorry, I hope people can actually read this. This is negative Q to the 6 minus Q squared plus Q to the negative 6 minus Q to the negative 8. So positive and negative powers, but otherwise just a polynomial in Q. And now, this polynomial that we calculate from a link is actually in some sense really easy to calculate, at least in the sense that I can show you the definition in just one slide. You could go away and do the calculations yourself if you like. The point is it's defined by some local skein relations. So what does that mean? It means you should look in the knot or the link that you're starting with and find some crossing, a place where the two strings cross over each other, and replace this crossing with a linear combination of two simpler pictures where there's no longer a crossing. The strings have sort of been hooked up in a different way, either this way or this way, and we're going to replace this crossing with a linear combination in the sense that each of these pictures is now some simpler knot, where there's one fewer crossing in the picture, and we're going to just take a sort of formal linear combination of knots, A times whatever this knot was, and A to the minus 1 times whatever this knot is. Okay? And now, keep doing that. Keep on getting rid of crossings at the expense of having more and more terms in the linear combination. And whenever you see an unknot, just an unknotted circle of string, you can delete that and multiply what you have left over by this little Laurent polynomial, minus a squared minus a to the negative 2. And at the end of the day, you'll have removed all the crossings, so it's just a bunch of closed loops, and then you'll have removed all the loops, and you'll just end up with some Laurent polynomial in A, and there's some little change of variables, which I'm going to have to use a few times during the talk. I'm sorry this is so tiny, Q equals minus a squared. So Q and A are just the same thing, just a change of variables. Okay, so now you know what the Jones polynomial is. If I hand you a drawing of a knot, you can use these rules to calculate it. So let's do that. Let's do a little example up in the top corner there, and just those little skein relations, so you can remember what the definition is. So before we do our calculation, let's do a little lemma. Let's just look at what you get if you have a piece of string with a kink in it. Well, it's just got one crossing, so we replace that by this linear combination. And then this first term here has a circle in it, so we'll replace that with minus a squared minus a to the negative 2. Some terms cancel if you check, and you just get minus a cubed times an untwisted piece of string. Okay, so that's a nice little lemma. let's do a calculation now. This is the hop link, just two pieces of string looping through each other. Let's replace this top crossing with the linear combination. Use this lemma here to remove the kink in that term, and the lemma here to remove the kink in that term, and replace the circles with our usual rule, and we get at the end just some polynomial, some Laurent polynomial in Q. Okay, piece of cake. Now, I said at the beginning that it's an invariant of links. What does that mean? Well, being an invariant just means that it, if I take the knot and mix it up first, and then hand it to you, you'll always calculate the same answer, no matter how I rearrange the knot before I handed it to you. And you formalize this by saying that two links are isotopic, meaning one can be deformed into the other without cutting it or moving strings through each other. And it turns out that two links are isotopic if they differ by a sequence of randomizer moves. So if you look at the first term here and the last term here in this equation, this is obviously something you want to hold. If you've got two pieces of string that just sort of overlap like that, you should be able to separate the two arcs. That's not changing the knot at all. And in between here is some little calculation using the rules of the Jones polynomial, checking that you really will always get the same answer, regardless of which of those two pictures you see. And then the somewhat harder thing that you could compute as an exercise is that this definition I gave you for the Jones polynomial will always produce the same answer if you see this diagram or if you replace that diagram by this one. It's just a little calculation expanding on the terms. Okay. And those little calculations then prove for you that this thing we've defined is actually an invariant of links. No matter how we lay the piece of, no matter how we lay the knot down on the table and start looking for crossings, we're always going to get the same answer at the end of the day. Okay. Any questions?
Well, just yeah, about your first example computation. So
yep.
It's not quite like I could imagine my process would be a straight line with the same polynomial as just this thing that would all be out.
Okay.
And they don't.
And they don't. Yeah. So this is, it's an invariant of frame links, to be precise. So you should think of your link as being tied at a piece of ribbon, and in a ribbon you can see visibly if it's got a full twist in it, and we allow different answers for the frame. You can correct it so that goes away. But in some sense, it's better not to do that correction. Okay. Where are we? Okay. Okay, the Jones polynomial was discovered back in 1984, and it immediately revolutionized knot theory. It was sort of strange and unexpected that this little gadget existed, and it let people prove a whole lot of theorems just sort of in classical knot theory. But since then, it sort of unfurled this revolution in lots of other fields as well. And the Jones polynomial is now useful all over three-manifold topology. We've learned all sorts of things about quantum field theory out of thinking about the Jones polynomial. The Jones polynomial is used to study knotting in DNA. And what I want to talk about today is the relevance of the Jones polynomial for computer science and also for condensed matter physics. Okay, but the big question that we have to now think about is how hard is it, in the precise sort of algorithmic sense, how hard is the Jones polynomial to compute? Okay. And what I want to tell you is that computing the Jones polynomial is precisely as hard as doing quantum computation. And we're going to have to work out what that sentence actually means. Now, before we work out what that actually means, let's spend a little while talking about what is quantum computation anyway. So, let me give the definition and then you can ask questions if you want. So a decision problem, let's call it L. So this is going to be something, you should think like something like the traveling salesman. Traveling salesman isn't a quantum problem, but you might ask, if I give you this collection of cities and distances between them, is there a path between these cities of less than 1,000 miles? That's a question. You give me some input, and I'm just expected to answer yes or no on the input you give me. Okay, so a decision problem is in BQP, which is just the formal name for quantum computation. If there exists a uniform family, which we'll say, of quantum circuits, Qn, so for each integer n, there's going to be some quantum circuit, such that the quantum circuit QN takes N just classical bits of input, so it gets N binary bits as input, and it outputs a single bit. So the parameter N here is just so that you can give me inputs of different sizes. You can give me a traveling salesman problem with 1,000 cities or 1,000,000,000 cities, and we'll just have different parameters of N determining how big the input problem is. And I'm allowed to use a different circuit for each different input size for the problem. Okay, now what's the essential thing? If this decision problem is meant to be false on that input, then the probability, so that we're doing quantum mechanics, we're about to be doing quantum mechanics, so there's some quantum probability that this circuit of size length of x applied to the input x, if that output bit is one with probability less than 1/3, sorry, I got my ifs wrong. If L of x is false, then this probability that Q outputs 1 must be less than 1/3. And if L of x is true, the probability that Q applied to x outputs 1 must be at least 2/3. Okay? So you can see that if you had such a circuit that behaved with these probabilities, you could quickly decide if L of x was true or false. You'd just run this experiment a few times, and if L of x was false, you'd expect that that the majority of these outputs would be zero. If L of x is true, you'd expect the majority of these outputs would be true. Okay, let me now go back in and define what a uniform family and a quantum circuit are. So first, a quantum circuit. So a quantum circuit, you should think of as being like a classical circuit, but it uses unitary operators instead of Boolean gates. So let's just look at this picture for a moment. On the left here, we have a whole lot of input strings coming in, and those input strings pass through some gates, which are represented by boxes here, and we get some output at the end. Now, in a classical circuit, these boxes here might be things like AND gates, or OR gates, or XOR gates, and so on. They take some inputs and do Boolean operations on those inputs. For a quantum circuit, we mean something slightly different. What we're thinking about here is that each line here is carrying this little two-dimensional vector space, and the input to one of these quantum circuits is going to be some vector in the tensor product of a whole lot of little two-dimensional vector spaces. So if we have, how many strings are there? There's 9 strings there. So the input to this quantum circuit will be some vector in some 2^9 dimensional space. And each of these boxes now just represents applying some unitary operator to the vector space associated with those strings here. So we have 4 strings coming in here. So the tensor product of those 4 strings is carrying this 2^4 dimensional vector space. And now this is just this box carries some arbitrary unitary operator on that 2^4 dimensional vector space. When you stick in a vector here, you just apply that unitary operator and look at what vector you get out on the other side. Okay, so what does it mean to apply one of these circuits? Remember, our input here was just this classical string of n bits. What does it mean to apply a quantum circuit to it? Well, in each of these two-dimensional vector spaces, we pick a basis, which we call 0 and 1. And in this vector space, we choose the appropriate basis vector depending on whether that bit is 0 or 1. In this vector space, we choose the appropriate basis vector depending on the input with 0 and 1, and so on. We apply this crazy composition of unitary operators, and we get some element out at the end. So we come over and look at this formula here. Here we took our input x, we applied our unitary operator to it, applied u to x, and finally we just take the inner product of the vector we get out at the end with some fixed vector, the all zeros basis vector. Okay? And the absolute value squared of that inner product is some number between 0 and 1. Okay, and that's what we refer to as the probability that that the input x gives output 0 or output 1. Okay, so, sorry, I guess I said that a moment ago. Okay. Did that make sense, what a quantum circuit was? Ask a question. Yeah.
You say there that it takes the n bits as inputs and outputs a single bit.
Yeah.
I can't see the single bit.
Okay, yeah, okay, okay. It's really what's happening is that so we've got this vector that we obtained by taking the input and applying u to it, okay? And now we're just calculating its projections onto this vector here, the all zeros vector, or the projection onto the orthogonal complement of just that one vector there, okay? And all that we're saying is the quantum mechanical probability of obtaining this all zeros vector is just the absolute value squared of the projection onto that 0, 0, 0 vector, and we're thinking of the projection onto that all zeros vector as being the 0 output, and the projection onto the entire complement as being the 1 output. Okay? So, I'm just telling you a single number here, P of x, defined by this formula, and quantum mechanically it's the probability that we measure u of x to be this all zeros vector.
Not a zero or one.
Mm-hmm. It's not a bit.
No, yeah. So we don't. Given this quantum circuit, we can measure the probability that the answer is this fixed vector here that consists of all zeros, or the probability that it's something else. And those are the two probabilities that we think of as being the probability of maybe it's better to think of the output as being yes or no. But this is the probability of the quantum circuit saying yes. Any other questions about that? Okay. We have to fill in one little technical detail about what a uniform family is here. For each n telling you the size of the input, you're allowed to use a different quantum circuit. And we just need to make sure that you're not cheating. That is, there has to be a classical, old-fashioned algorithm that runs in polynomial time in the size of n, that writes down the quantum circuit. So we're just saying we can't cheat by using extremely elaborate quantum circuits for high n's that we somehow like spend lots of time cooking up. The qn's have to be, you have to be able to write them down very efficiently as soon as I tell you the input size. Okay, that's just ensuring we're not cheating. Okay, so this is the notion of a quantum computation Okay. So next I want to ask, what can quantum computers actually do? Well, of course, they can't do anything because they don't exist yet. But what does this model of computation allow you to do? So not that much. The first thing is that whatever you read in newspapers, quantum computers are not exponentially parallel. They don't try all possible answers at once in parallel universes and magically come up with the answer. They don't do very, very much at all. If you want to read some more about what they can and can't do, I highly recommend reading Scott Aronson's blog. He's at MIT and a very good writer, and he describes what he works on as studying what computers we don't have yet can't do. His research is all about sort of defining the limits of what quantum computation could possibly do if we pretend that we actually had quantum computers. Okay. So what's the short list of things that we can do with a quantum computer? We can do unstructured search in squared n time. If I give you a haystack and ask you to look for a needle in it, the time it takes you to find the needle should be proportional to the number of bits of straw in the haystack, okay? It should take time to do an unstructured search problem. And somewhat ridiculously, there's a quantum algorithm that lets you find a needle in a haystack and square it in time, which is kind of cool all by itself. But it's not an exponential speed-up, it's sort of a polynomial speed-up going from n down to square root n. Still interesting. Another thing that it can do is factorize integers in polynomial time. This is Shor's famous algorithm, and it's a special case of a sort of more general thing called the discrete log problem. And this is an exponential speed-up as far as we're aware. We think that you can't do integer factorization in polynomial time. Although, if you happen to have read The Guardian this morning about the latest things out from Snowden, it seems possible the NSA maybe does have a bit of an advantage over us here. Apparently, they can break some encryption schemes we thought were okay. Another thing that it can do is efficient computation, efficient simulation of quantum systems, and it can evaluate the Jones polynomial. And this last one is the thing that I'm going to spend some more time telling you about, but I want to say at this point that this efficient simulation of quantum systems thing is actually the big deal. This integer factorization thing, who cares? I mean, maybe if I have a quantum computer, I can like read your bank account details or something like that, but who cares? The NSA can already do that, it seems. But this one is a big deal, and it's very plausible that having quantum computation would let you do things like work out with a certain material superconduct at room temperature without building them. You just simulate them in your quantum computer, and this could potentially be a really fantastic application of being able to do quantum computation. But we're going to stick with thinking about the Jones polynomial for now. Okay, so I have to now try and justify this claim that computing the Jones polynomial is precisely as hard as doing quantum computation. So we're going to do two steps. Say these two things are equally hard, we're going to have to show the inequalities in both directions. And so one direction is going to be taking any quantum algorithm, that is any decision problem we know is in BQP, and showing that you can produce some Jones polynomial evaluation that tells you the answers to that problem in BQP. But the thing we're going to do first is just write down a quantum algorithm in the sense that we just described, building some quantum circuits that let us evaluate the Jones polynomial. So we're going to discuss this first. Okay, so here's a theorem. Okay, so take a braid B. I'll say in just a second what exactly a braid is. N strands and M crossings. And choose a root of unity. X of pi I over k, and a tolerance, epsilon. And then there exists a quantum algorithm, and it's the input size, the complexity of these circuits we're going to build are only polynomial in all of these parameters, n, m, k, and 1 over epsilon. And what does this polynomial algorithm do? Well, it approximates the Jones polynomial of something called the Platt closure, I'll say this in a second, at this particular value of q to within epsilon. It's going to be a quantum circuit that answers, is this Jones polynomial at this number within epsilon, within epsilon of some specified value. Okay, it's going to tell us how to additively approximate particular evaluations of the Jones polynomial at particular roots of unity. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about braids, Platt closures. I'm just going to tell you the definitions of all these things by telling you drawing pictures. These things here are braids, okay? They're bits of string that run from some fixed endpoints on the left to endpoints on the right. These two braids are different because, well, this one the string goes over and this one the string goes under. You can't just form this braid into this one. These two braids over here are just the same braid because you can just isotope one into the other without cutting or moving things through each other. This guy, however, is just not a braid at all. To be a braid, all the strings have to only move from left to right. This one, the string loops back on itself. Okay? And finally, given a braid, so here's a braid drawn inside the box, you can take what's called its Platt closure. Just put these little loops on the top and some loops on the bottom, and you get something with a link, now just a tied up piece of string. And it's pretty easy to see that given any link, you can actually sort of comb it out and then wrap it as the Platt closure of some braid. And so...
what do I do if I have an odd number of strings?
You can put a twist. Just grab one of your bits of string and put a full twist in it, and then pull it. Okay, so although this theorem looks like it's talking about braids and their Platt closures, we're really talking about arbitrary links here, because you can write links as Platt closures. Okay, so I'm going to briefly sketch the idea of this theorem, but let me give proper acknowledgements first. This isn't my theorem. The original paper that did this, although it's not at all obvious from reading this paper that that's what's going on, is by Michael Friedman, Alexei Kanaev, and Jing Han Wang. And then a later paper gave a very clear and more conceptual description of this algorithm by Dominique Vaughan and Seth. And the proof that I'm going to give you just the sketch of is directly from there. Okay. I'm now going to give you the short sketch. Okay. So we're going to try and calculate the Jones polynomial using this thing called the path model, which I'm just going to pull out of a hat and tell you it exists. So first of all, I'm just going to define this vector space Hn, which is going to be linear combinations of paths of length n on this graph ak minus 1. So ak minus 1 is this very simple graph, it's just this linear chain of vertices and edges, okay? And I'm just thinking about paths that start at this leftmost vertex and then for n steps just do whatever they like, going up or down on this graph, okay? And so I'm just going to look at this vector space, linear combinations of those paths. Here are just some examples of paths. So I'm thinking of things which start at zero here and then maybe go two steps up and one step down, and one step up and two steps down, and so on. Okay, so these are the sorts of, these are the basis vectors in the little vector space that I've just defined. Okay, now pulling something out of the hat here, there's a representation of the n-strand braid group on this vector space Hn. So maybe I didn't say this, but if you think about braids with n strands, they form a group just by gluing them end to end. The multiplication of braids is just concatenating them. And what I'm just going to say is that there's a representation of those braid groups on this vector space Hn. And in fact, the Jones polynomial comes out of this representation in a very simple way. There's some particular vectors called z in Hn, and the way that you can calculate the Jones polynomial of a Platt closure is you start with your vector z, you apply your braid b to it to get another vector in this vector space, and then you take the inner product with the original vector z again, and that's some number, and that number is the Jones polynomial evaluated at this particular root of unity, x of pi I over k. Remember the parameter k here came in the length of the path, but it also came in the way that the braid group acts on its vector space. Okay, so this is some magic out of a hat that lets us talk about the Jones polynomial in terms of some inner products of vectors. And so this is kind of looking more like the thing that we need in a quantum computation. You need to take this braid here and like write it as a quantum circuit in some sense. So how does this go? Well, I'm going to take this vector space, paths of length n, on ak minus 1, and I'm going to embed it in this big boring vector space. So I'm just going to take this n-fold tensor product of a bunch of two-dimensional vector spaces, where a basis vector in this guy is just a sequence of up, down, up, up, down, up, down, up. Okay, and I'm just going to think of a particular path in this vector space as being, well, the obvious corresponding vector in this vector space. I just follow the path, see if it's going up or down at each step. Now, certainly Hn isn't all of this vector space, okay? Because if we're, say, on the graph ak minus 1, there's a limit to how many times we can go up in a row, okay? So this is some subspace of this big vector space. But what I can think about is, in this vector space sitting inside this tensor product, how the braid group acts. If I cross over two strings, say the eighth string and the a plus one string, how does that look with respect to sort of this tensor product decomposition of that space? And what I would hope is that it sort of acts locally. That is, if I'm braiding the strings at position a and a plus one, I might hope that in this representation of the braid group embedded in this bigger vector space, we're only doing anything in the sort of the eighth and eighth plus first tensor factors of this big tensor product. Certainly that's not the case. The way the braid group acts also depends on the height of the path at the moment, but there's this nice trick. Just depressed back instead of forward. There's this nice trick using some auxiliary registers that let you keep track of this. So what's the idea here? We want to think of the braid acting on these two strings as just some unitary operator that only sees these two strings. But we need this little bit of extra information about the height of the path at the moment. But it turns out you can arrange that. Maybe people can't see the picture here. Let me move to this one. It turns out you can arrange to have that information available. You have a few extra bits here, log k, many of them. And then you do a few little unitary operations here that basically just accumulate these auxiliary registers, the height of the path when you get up to this point. That is, it just counts how many of these strings are carrying the up basis vector at the moment, for minus the number that are carrying the down basis vector at the moment. And then finally, when it's time to act using the braid, you also have to involve those extra auxiliary registers because they can tell you what height you're at. And then at the end of the day, actually, quantum computations are always invertible. Unitary operators are invertible. You have to sort of clean up afterwards and reset everything back to where you were at the beginning. So you need to do a little bit of cleanup work. Okay. This is only meant to be a sketch, and I don't expect that this actually made detailed sense. I just wanted to give the vague idea of how you take a braid and build a quantum circuit. Okay. So that's their lovely theorem, that we can build, for each braid, we can quickly build a quantum circuit following this kind of recipe, and because of this property of the path model, the probabilities that we get out at the end will be very closely related to the evaluations of the Jones polynomial at the probability that we're in. Okay, that was one direction. What about the other direction? We need to take an arbitrary quantum algorithm and express its answers in terms of evaluations of the Jones polynomial. So this is, originally a theorem of Friedman and Wong, this time with Larson, and the version that I'm stating here is it's a slightly cleaned up version due to Aronov and Arad. And so what they say here is that if we have some BQP decision problem L, so of course, and what I really mean by a BQP decision problem is both the decision problem and its solution, that is, the way of constructing the family of circuits that tells you the answer. We're going to now produce an associated, for freak input, we're going to produce a braid where the probabilities of the output from the quantum circuits give you constraints on the evaluations of the Jones polynomial and the flat closures of those braids, and that essentially means that if you could rapidly evaluate all of these Jones polynomials, then you would be able to sort of simulate the quantum system. You'd be able to simulate the quantum algorithm just by doing Jones polynomial evaluation. So what exactly does this theorem say? You've got some BQP decision problem, fix a root of unity, q the exponential of pi I over k. Now it's some strange constraints. We have to say k equals 5, or k is at least 7. And then, for any particular input for this decision problem x, in polynomial time, we can prepare a braid b sub x, say it's got n strands, so that the evaluation of the Jones polynomial of the Platt closure, well, times some annoying normalization factor we have to put in here, is less than 1/3 if L of x is true, and this same quantity is greater than 2/3 if L of x is false. Okay. Let me see where we are for time. Okay. So just to say this again, this is showing you is that if you had some oracular machinery that could evaluate the Jones polynomial quickly, you'd be able to give all the same answers as any quantum algorithm. Okay. So the sketch.
I would think, well, trying to decide if I actually want to say anything about it, or if I'd have to go through it so fast it would be completely useless. Well, it basically uses the sort of almost exactly the reverse idea of the previous sketch. Basically, if you show me some quantum circuit, some collection of unitary operators arranged in that sort of pattern that I had before, I can take each of those unitary operators and very efficiently produce some braid that has almost the same effect as that unitary operator. Another way of thinking about this is that if I think about a unitary operator on this on a 2n-dimensional vector space, there's some way that I can cook up a representation of the braid group on that 2n-dimensional vector space, so that there's a braid of only polynomial length within epsilon of every single point in that unitary group. Okay, so it's some little linear algebra problem. And you need to cook up special representations of the braid group, and then you show that every single point in this unitary group, you can write down a braid that's very close to that point. And that lets you basically convert a quantum circuit into a braid whose Jones polynomial you'd like to know the answer. Okay. So that was a very, very, very quick attempt to explain how you can go back and forth between quantum algorithms and evaluations of the Jones polynomial. And that's meant to be the justification of the statement, computing the Jones polynomial is as hard as quantum computation. Now that in itself maybe is only the sort of thing that could excite a computer scientist. But there's more to the story. Because these two things, which are equally hard to calculate, can be calculated using some topological field theory. Whether you call this mathematics or physics is maybe a little bit unclear. Okay, so the claim that I want to make is that there are physical systems, actual devices that people can or at least hope to be able to build in their laboratories, which will just magically compute Jones polynomials for you in polynomial time and the complexity of the knot. And in particular, this means that if you can really build these devices, then you can do all of quantum computation by converting your quantum problem into a particular braid you want to calculate the Jones polynomial for, and then turning the crank on these actual physical devices. Okay. So what is a topological field theory? So a topological field theory is a gadget that, at least a 2 plus 1 dimensional topological field theory, is a gadget that to every surface, to every two-manifold, surface of a donut, the surface of some higher unit surface, a Hilbert space, so for the sigma or right, C of sigma, this Hilbert space associated with the surface. And to reach cobordism, so here I have in mind some three-manifold M, that's a manifold with boundary. It's got an incoming boundary and an outgoing boundary. So maybe just drawing a picture here, I might take, so here's some two manifolds, just a disk with two punctures cut out of it. And here's another two manifold, a disk with another puncture cut out of it. And so the sort of thing I have in mind is the following three manifold. So I'm thinking about all of this region, the region outside the stuff that I've drilled out in the center. This cobordism, I want to think of it as having an incoming boundary, which is this two-manifold, and an outgoing manifold, that two-manifold at the top. And a topological field theory for each such cobordism gives me a unitary operator going from the Hilbert space associated to the incoming boundary to the Hilbert space associated to the outgoing boundary. Okay. So what can you do with a topological field theory? Well, maybe this was not exactly the right picture to draw. Maybe I should have drawn this picture first, where I'm thinking of a punctured disk and I'm just moving the two punctures around each other. You can think of any braid as giving you some cobordism from a punctured disk to a punctured disk. You can just stick your fingers in some of the punctures and braid them around each other according to the string. Okay, so for every braid, we get some cobordism. and then the TQFT gives us some unitary operator corresponding to the braid. That is, a topological field theory gives us a unitary representation of the braid group on this vector space. The n-strand braid group is acting on the vector space associated with the disk with n punctures in it. And a discovery that goes back to the beginning of time in this subject, due to Widen, Reshetykin, and Durayev, is that for each root of unity k, there's some topological field theory, so that if you want to evaluate the Jones polynomial of the Platt closure of a braid at this kth root of unity, then what you can do is, well, there's some God-given vector z in this Hilbert space for the disk with n punctures. You then apply the braid to that using the TQFT, and then finally compute the inner product in the Hilbert space with this God-given vector z. And so this is telling us another way to compute Jones polynomials of Platt closures as these inner products of the action of braids given by the TQFT. Okay, so that's cute. What's it good for? Well, these topological field theories were in some sense first invented because real quantum field theory is too hard for mathematicians and we can't prove many theorems about it. And topological field theories were meant to be a baby version. Well, maybe we'd thrown the baby out with the bathwater already, but they were simple enough to be able to understand it. And then the sort of shocking surprise is that topological field theories actually turn up as descriptions of real physical systems. And in particular, it looks like the fractional quantum Hall effect is something where topological field theory is the right piece of mathematics to model these. So there are two particularly interesting phases in the fractional quantum Hall effect world. It's 5/2 state, and it's 12/5 state, whatever they are. And they seem to correspond to the topological field theories corresponding to fourth roots of unity and, with a bit of a question mark, fifth roots of unity. And if you remember a few slides back, in Aronov and Arad's theorem about which roots of unity the Jones polynomial let you do quantum computation, well, fifth was one of those. You're allowed at fifth roots of unity, or greater than equal to seventh roots of unity, everything was good. So this 5 is a very encouraging 5 to notice. So what's going on here? Well, when you build a fractional quantum Hall effect device, when you build a fractional quantum Hall effect device, you're doing something at the interface between these two gallium arsenide crystals, and it's really a two-dimensional system. And you end up getting a little puddle of this fractional quantum Hall effect state. And what you might imagine is that, well, maybe your puddle has some defects in it, maybe because you stuck your electron microscope there and poked it, or you put something there before you built the device. And the expectation is that the ground state Hilbert space, the quantum mechanical description of the ground state of this system, is going to be exactly that vector space that the topological field theory tells you is associated with this punctured disk. So notice in particular that means it doesn't depend on how big the disk is, it doesn't depend on where the punctures are. All that it depends on is just how many punctures there are in the disk. Okay? And in particular, if you could build little fractional quantum Hall effect devices where you had some way to move these punctures around each other, this is getting to be flights of fancy rather than actual engineering at this point, then you would be able to do measurements on these devices that would give you that would tell you the evaluations of the Jones polynomial. Okay, so maybe just summarizing that again, if you could really build these devices and manipulate them in the way I described, moving punches around each other, we would have a quantum computer. You take your quantum algorithm, so your quantum algorithm is some unitary operator for each input size n. You'd approximate that unitary operator by some braid. You'd then actually literally braid the defects in your system around each other according to that braid, and then some measurement at the end of the day would read off the answer whether
You'd have to do this a few times and see if you got more zeros or ones, and that would tell you the answer to your decision problem that you start.
Oh. So Mike Friedman and his group at Microsoft Station Q are really actually trying to do this. Microsoft is actually spending money on this completely ridiculously crazy idea. Okay. So that was the physics of it. Where's the maths? Something that I've been thinking about a lot is what topological field theories are there out there? There are these two that I've mentioned that maybe they see in the laboratory, but we would like to know what else is possible, both for the sake of understanding which ones might be useful for quantum computing, and maybe even to give some hints to the physicists about what to look for next, if we know what else is out there. So let me just say a little bit about that. So these 2+1 dimensional topological field theories come in different flavors, and the very nicest ones are ones that are called fully extended topological field theories. And it's sort of only a matter of taste, I guess, whether you expect these fully extended ones, the physically relevant ones, or not. I think they probably are. Okay, and the point is that these particularly nice 2+1 dimensional field theories, the fully extended ones, are actually entirely determined by this little piece of algebraic data called the fusion category. And if you came to my talk earlier today, which I thought was actually going to come after this colloquium talk, would have made more sense maybe, I said a bunch about fusion categories in that earlier talk. And one thing I said there is that fusion categories are a common generalization of finite groups and quantum groups. And maybe the thing to say is that the TFTs that I mentioned on the previous page are the very simplest ones associated to fusion categories coming from quantum groups. Okay. But besides those ones coming from finite groups and quantum groups, we've been putting lots of effort into understanding all the other possible fusion categories, and hence the other possible fully extended 2+1 dimensional TFTs. And here's some pictures of my wonderful co-authors who've been doing all this for me. So the question that then arises is which of these topological field theories are actually good enough to do quantum computing? So I showed you that one theorem earlier that said that these ones associated with the Jones polynomial at a fifth root of unity or greater than or equal to seventh root of unity were good enough for doing quantum computation, and we'd like to have a sort of general answer to that. And at least we have some conjectures now along these lines. So there are some particularly nice topological field theories coming from modular tensor categories, sort of some more special version of a fusion category. And Eric Raoul has this conjecture that a modular tensor category is universal for quantum computation, if and only if it is not weakly integral. And for people who came along to my talk earlier today, weakly integral means the dimensions of all the objects are square roots of integers. You'd expect dimensions of things to be integers, but in the world of fusion categories, that doesn't happen. And this weakly integral idea is that maybe things aren't so bad. Dimensions are just square roots of integers, which is not that much worse than integers themselves. And then Ostrich's conjecture, maybe, I'm not sure, I might be putting words in his mouth here, is that a fusion category is weakly integral if and only if it's weakly group-like, which basically means that it's very closely related to representations of finite groups. And putting these two conjectures together, it suggests that the things that should be, the fusion categories that should be universal for doing quantum computation should be exactly those ones that are very far from being like finite groups, that are the more exotic versions of fusion categories. Yeah, so we should explore the exotic fusion category some more. And that's all I have. Thanks.
Any questions? I have a question, which is, so what about other knot invariants? Could you also talk about those in terms of doing quantum algorithms?
Yeah, so
there's a, I mean, there's a very big family of knot invariants coming from quantum groups, and the Jones polynomial was the first one that was discovered that's associated to the group SU2. But for every other classical Lie group you know, there's an associated collection of knot invariants, and the expectation is that nearly all of those are universal for quantum computation. So. Yes, I mean, that's one of the big families of examples of these 2+1 dimensional field theories, all the ones coming from all the different classical groups besides just SU2.
Questions? Oh, well, if not, I will present you with this. Thank you for your talk.
Thank you. That looks nice.
Everyone, please, thanks for